Juana Villena with Indeed Quotas Sanya. So firstly, thank you to the entire community and the Quintus and the Strass families and the Gottesmans, not only for your children whom I adore, but also for hosting this beautiful evening and for the YU Kollel for not only putting together the Yachid Challah, but for inviting me for the zchut of learning Torah together with you for the past few hours, over which I have to share with you just a few observations. And as I was speaking to numerous students and asking them how the Torah is thriving and growing in Chicago, they all mentioned, you have to just hear what Rabbi Grant has been doing. We have to share with you some of the projects that he has incorporated and initiated here. And it's wonderful to see just the growth, the continuous growth of Torah. And by this I mean certainly the content, but also the passion and the scope. And it is a true zchut and pleasure to be part of that this evening. So without further ado, we're going to start with, I think, a very timely topic, and that is understanding, going back to the time period of Tkufa Bayichini, how during that time, the various chachamim, the gedolei hador, responded to Churban. And by timely, I mean not only with regard to this evening being the Erev of Shivasar B'Tammuz, the beginning of this process was actually a very gradual process during the time of the Second Temple destruction, but particularly to appreciate the relevance for our time, as unfortunately we know over the past few weeks and over the past few months, really, the Churban and the destruction, the sorrows that are now affecting Am Yisrael. The question is obviously, how do we respond? How are we meant to respond to different time periods of destruction and despair that can affect us as a people? And sometimes when we turn back, particularly to the beginnings and the origins of Rabbinic Judaism, which is the first time when the Chachamim are going to record for us how they responded and the long-term messages that we're going to see from the Tanaim themselves, how they're going to express their response, but all the more so even later Amoraim, when they look back at history through their 2020 hindsight and are able to also note different ways that different leaders during the generation responded so that we can then take heed and ensure that we respond properly for our time. So we're going to begin with understanding not just Karpitz crisis and conflict, but how the different leaders who were witness to the gradual disintegration and the increasing oppressive Roman rule, how they are going to respond to all this. We begin with one of the leaders of the generation for whom Rabbi Yochanan the Amora looks back, and he actually is going to hold him responsible for Churban Bayit Sheni. This is the famous story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, but we're going to engage ourselves together this evening with a little bit of Talmudic analysis as we look at various Midrashei Churban. And just to remind you, with regard to rabbinic homiletics, whenever we look at a midrash, part of the challenge is going to be to appreciate how Chazal weave psukim, and henceforth call it a midrash, how they weave psukim from Tanakh to their modern understanding, and how they then are going to bring a story to life in a very poignant manner, carefully selecting different words and a particular structure and highlighting their message. Amma Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan the Amora is looking back more or less four generations, as he says, it says in the Pasuk, Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid, Umakshe Lipo Yipol Ra'a, Akamsa Uvar Kamsa Charuv Yerushalayim. What is the evil, the fear that has befallen one? This is the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. So the Gemara a few lines later asks, what happened? Akamsa Uvar Kamsa Charuv Yerushalayim? Why did Rabbi Yochanan say such a remarkable and startling statement? Because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, because of two personalities, the entire Yerushalayim was destroyed. And even without continuing for a moment, it's interesting to note that these two personalities, of only which one we're really going to hear elaborated upon, if we look at their names even, can anyone tell me, what does Kamsa mean? The name Kamsa means comets, that's right. Miserly, withholding oneself. Already, I don't know what the real names of these personalities were, and we're going to see that one doesn't even actively appear within the story. Rather, Chazal are pinpointing there are certain character traits for which the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And right away, it was because of kamtsanut. It was because of the miserly attitude of the characters during that time. But another very interesting idea that can be extrapolated simply from the names themselves. One is Kamsa, the other is Bar Kamsa. What does that tell you about the relationship between perhaps even these two, again, somewhat fictional characters, even though we're going to see a real story takes place? One is Kamsa, the other is Ben Kamsa. They are father and son. We're speaking about, again, a generational phenomenon, but also one where we're going to see a third party of whom we don't even hear his name. He's friendly with Kamsa, but he is enemies with Bar Kamsa. One would think, if a father knew that an acquaintance of his hated his son, what should the father do? The father should either, that's right, discontinue his relationship with that acquaintance and try to make peace between them. And yet, it seems that this was a very commonplace phenomenon. No, he likes Kamsa, and he despises the son Bar Kamsa, and there is a rift between the generations themselves. Perhaps Kamsa and Bar Kamsa themselves didn't get along. So let's continue with the story. Dahu Gavra Derachame Kamsa. There was a man who liked Kamsa, Uval Devave Bar Kamsa, but he was terrible enemies with Bar Kamsa. Avad Su'udata. He made a huge su'uda, Amarle Lishmaya, Zil Ate Li Kamsa. He sent out his messenger, go and invite Kamsa. We all know this famous story. Azal Atale, Bar Kamsa. He mistakenly invited the enemy character, Bar Kamsa. Ativ Ashkache Dehavi Yativ. And Bar Kamsa then actually comes to the party. What does that tell you? If the enemy who was invited comes to the party, he clearly understood that what does the host want to do? He wants to make peace, reconciliation over here. So he sits down. Amarle michte yahu gavra bal devave hahu gavra hu mai bayitacha. Excuse me, what are you doing here? Right? I don't like you. Then kum puk, get up and leave. Get out of here. Amarle hoel va'ate shafkan. But now that I'm already sitting at the party, v'yahavne lecha dami ma da'achilna v'shatina. Please let me stay here sitting at the party, and I promise you, I will pay for my plate. I will pay for whatever I eat and I drink. Amarle, lo. He said, no, Amarle, yahavnele dme palga du su'udatech. I'll pay for half of the entire su'uda. The host once again says, no. So this time Bar Kamsa says, I'll pay dme chula su'udatech. I'll pay for the entire party. Amarle, lo. Nata biyade. And notice how the Gemara here goes out of its way to illustrate what goes on in the story. He picked him up with his hands, v'ukima v'ufke. What a bouncer. He gets him up and throws him out the door. Amar Bar Kamsa tells himself, ho'il v'hafe yatve rabbanan. The very fact that rabbanan were sitting there, v'lo machube. Anna, they didn't say anything. Silence is acquiescence. They must have agreed to this. Shmamina kanichuluhu. Apparently, they were okay with what happened. Izil ichuvuhu kortza beimalka. At that moment, he decided, if this is how the leadership is responding to such animosity, if this is how they respond, in fact, at a time of crisis, then I'm going to go and slander them before the emperor. Lo and behold, that's what he does. Azal Amarla le Kesar. He goes to the emperor of Rome. Mardu b'cha Yehudai. Do you know the Jews are rebelling against you? Amarle mi emar. You know who says? Amarle, I'll prove it to you. Shadar lehu karbana. Send a karban, the emperor's karban. This became part of the daily sacrifice under the Romans, beginning with Pompey. Send a sacrifice. Chazit imikraf inlay. And let's see if they sacrifice the sacrifice of the emperor. Azal shadar bede agla tlata. He sent him off with a very healthy karban, bahade dekate shada be mume. But on the way, Bar Kamsa is going to inflict a wound upon the karban. Binif svatayim, according to the first opinion, he causes a wound on the lips. But some say the wound wasn't on the lips, but rather bedukin shebaayin, a little scratch by the eye. Can anyone tell me why does he select, and why is there even a Talmudic dispute with regard to where the mum was? Why is it so important? The mum is going to invalidate this animal as a korban. Why do we care whether it's by the lip or by the eye? What are Chazal trying to tell us? What does Bar Kamsa recognize? Where is there a mum? Where is there a blemish within Am Yisrael? Either by the lip, in what sense? Lashon hara, sinat chinam, the words of the host against him, or perhaps he's even referring to the fact that there's a blemish by the lip. There's something wrong. There's something missing to the power of the lips. Namely, the chachamim, the sages, what should they have done? They should have gotten up and spoken up, and they didn't. There's a mum in the svatayim, or maybe the mum is really in the eyes. Maybe there's a blemish in how people are looking one at the other, and how the leaders are looking at the status quo, and how people are judging one another. And he ultimately is trying to show the peoples and the leaders where the blemish of the people lie. Let's continue. Sure enough, the karban is brought, and these things that we know are considered mumim, the Gemara continues, but for him, for the emperor, for the guy, it's not considered a mum. So the Rabbanan, the leaders, when they received this karban, they all decided, you know what, we should really sacrifice it. Mishum shlom malchut. Just to keep the emperor happy. They wanted to offer it to preserve good relationships with the authorities. But Amar lohu Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkalus. But one of the leaders, the Kohanim, clearly a Gadol Hador, one of the most respected members of society, gets up and he says, no, we can't sacrifice it because Yomru, Ba'alei Mumin, Kriven Lagabei Mizbeach, people are going to learn an incorrect halacha. That is halachically incorrect to sacrifice a mum with a blemish, because then what will people think from this? That future karbanot can also be sacrificed even if they have a mum. So the other suggestion was, Savor Limikatle, let's just kill Bar Kamsa, or whoever sent this karban, so that he won't go back and report it to the authorities. Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkalus says, by the way, what would you think he should say when they say, so murder him, death to Bar Kamsa. What should he say? No, you can't do that because it's murder. And a little enthusiasm here. And he should say, how can you even suggest cold-blooded murder? But notice he gives a very, and I'm going to say, halachically oriented answer. He says, no, we can't do that. Not because there's something inherently wrong with homicide, but because yomru, matil mum bekachim yaharei. Because then people are going to reach the wrong halachic conclusion. They're going to think that people who sacrifice a karban with a blemish are worthy of death, are chayav mita. What happened then as a result? They all listened to Zachariah ben Afkalus, who says, we can't sacrifice it, but we also can't kill him, so we won't sacrifice it. And sure enough, the very next story in the Gemara is how the Emperor Nero sends Vespasian to begin the conquest of Yerushalayim, to besiege the city, which we all know is the beginning of the end of the story, beginning with Shavasar B'Tammuz. But that's not really the end of the Talmudic statement. The last statement, Rabbi Yochanan gets the last word. Looking back generations in history, Amma Rabbi Yochanan, Advatanuto shel Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkalus hechriva et beitenu, v'sarfa et hechalenu, v'higlitanu me'artzenu. And notice the irony of the statements. How did he begin? He began by saying, what is the source or the reason for the destruction of Yerushalayim? How did the story begin? I thought it was because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, what we generally repeat year after year between Shavasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, as this climactic story, the epitome of Sinat Chinam, for which the second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. But then it's almost as if Rav Yochanan here is offering a disclaimer. No, actually, it wasn't Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, for which Yerushalayim was destroyed. Whose fault is it really? And Vat Tanuto Shel Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkalus. It is Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkalus' fault. And notice how harsh he is. Because of, not Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkalus himself, but the anvatanut. What does that word mean? So it comes from anava, right, which generally is a noble character trait, the humility of a person. But anvatanut is looked upon in a deprecatory fashion by Chazal, too much humility. When someone is too passive, because of the passivity of Zachariah ben Avkalos, Hechriva et Beitenu, Visarfa et Hechalenu, Vihiglitanu me'artenu. Notice not only much harsher than his opening statement, but even slightly grammatically different. At first he said, Akamso Barkamsa Charuf Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was destroyed. The passive reflexive. Here, these are all active verbs. What Rav Zachariah ben Avkalos did, which could be looked at first glance, as simply passivity, as Shevi al Taaseh. How does Rabbi Yochanan look at it? No, his passivity actively caused the destruction. Hechriva sarfa vihiglitanu. The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the exile of Am Yisrael from Eretz Yisrael. Here we see one reaction to a time period of conflict. And that is, let's just avoid the conflict and adopt a rather myopic view of just following the letter of the law. But as any rabbi can tell you, whenever it comes to applying the letter of the law, what other factors must be taken into account, Rabbi? Anna, we also have to take into account the person who's asking. We also have to take into account the situation. And Rav Zachariah ben Avkalos was simply looking at the letter without appreciating the situation, without understanding that there are zealots who are willing to tear the society apart, without appreciating that the Romans are simply waiting for the moments of internal strife within Am Yisrael. And because of that, this passivity, the conflict is not going to be assuaged, but rather aggravated. This is one response that Chazal are teaching us. Make sure that you don't adapt this, not only with regard to political stances, but we're going to see halachically as well. For this is not the first time that Rav Zachariah ben Avkalos appears in the Gemara, although he doesn't appear that often. If you turn the page, we see two interesting sources. One that helps illustrate, or rather enhance the story, and gives us background image for some of the internal strife that Rabbi Yochanan is sensitive to, and that is to appreciate, firstly, the relationship between the rabbis at that time, so much so that according to one source in Avot to Rabbi Natan, Rav Zachariah ben Avkalos himself was one of the rabbis feasting at the meal where Bar Kamsa was overtly embarrassed, and he's the one who said to all the other rabbis, don't say anything. And obviously being consistent with his behavior, but firstly understanding that the rabbis during that time, to a certain degree, were beholden to the bourgeoisie of society. The wealthy men of Yerushalayim were their patrons for learning. So to a certain degree, so how did the Rabbanim, I don't want to say anything, I'm glad you're arriving. I told you, this is all to appreciate the relevancy for our time. But if the rabbis really are beholden to the upper classes, then they understood why couldn't they say anything, or so they thought. Because then, what was their justification? If we speak against our patrons, then they're going to cut off support of Talmud Torah. At least this way, we can continue to learn Talmud Torah. Perhaps one of the most famous stories, which proves the veracity of the realia of the time, is the following story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who hears that Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' father is coming to town to disavow, basically disown his son from the will. So what does he tell? Shema alav Hyrcanus aviv shaya lomid Torah etzel Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Amar elech va'adir Eliezer beni menachasai. I'm going to come and disown my son from the will. He was encouraged by his other sons. Amru oto hayom Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai yoshev v'doresh v'yushalayim. I'd like you to picture the scene. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is at a parlor meeting in front of the most wonderful benefactors of Yerushalayim, v'chol gedolei Yisrael yoshvim lefanav. And it doesn't mean the Torah scholars, because we're going to see in just a moment, all of the wealthiest patrons, the benefactors of Yerushalayim are there. Shama alav Shaba, when he heard that Hyrcanus, who was also a pretty wealthy man, but more from the farming classes, he said, Hoshiv lo shomrin. Please keep in mind, there were guards at the door. You tell me, what do you think the guards are at the door for? I thought this is a shir, an open shir. But it's not a community Torah lecture. Rather, this is by invitation only. Who do you think is invited to this parlor meeting?
Rich people.
The rich people. And therefore, there is a shomer by the door, making sure that he presents his invitation. Oh, I forgot to tell you, it also says black tie only. So again, they have to come in this way. So he says, when Hyrcanus, the wealthy man, comes in, don't let him sit down. Why? Because ultimately, he wanted him to move up the chairs so that he'd be sitting, as we see, with Ben Tzitzita Kesef and Nachdimon Ben Gurion and Kalba Savua, who throughout this time period in the Talmudic stories are viewed as the three wealthiest men of Yerushalayim. And he's trying to show Hyrcanus, you see, the kavod that is bestowed upon your son, Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. He makes a public display of the wise answers of Eliezer ben Hyrcanus to show his intellectual prowess, after which Hyrcanus says, "Wow, look at the respect that is shown by these benefactors to my son Hyrcanus," giving us a true picture of what's going on during that time, namely that the rabbis are beholden, that they are passive as a whole. But perhaps the stronger source, in Masechet Shabbat, source number 3, we hear about Rav Zacharia ben Avkalos in the following machloket that's presented one way in the Gemara and the opposite in the Tosefta. And that is a Mishnah or Tosefta. According to the Mishnah, it's Beit Shammai. According to the Tosefta, it's Beit Hillel, who says, Ma'avirin me'al ha'shulchan atzamot v'klifin, that if you have peels and bones, which have a status of muksa on Shabbat, he says it's okay. All you have to do is remove them from the table. Beit Shammai, and according to some, it's Beit Hillel, omrim, misaleka tatav lakula umenarin umavirin mipnei hashulchan. Or what else can you do? You can just remove the table. Move it and shake the table, and what will happen? The bones and the peels will drop from the table. So you have a choice. You can either actively remove them or shake them off. Amru alav al Rabbi Zacharia ben Avkalos, shayam machzir panav achorei hamita v'zorkan. What would Rav Zacharia ben Avkalos do? He would take his refuse and throw it behind the couch, right? As if instead of putting it down and making it muksa, as he was eating it, he would just discard of it simultaneously. In other words, who did he paskin like? Beit Hillel or Beit Shammai?
Neither.
Why? What does he want to show? Yeah, I can't decide. I can either be more lenient in one way or more stringent the other way. So you know what? Let me just avoid the situation entirely. How do I avoid the situation of what to do with my peels and bones on the table? Don't let them fall on the table. Instead, I'll just throw them behind me and make a mess. And basically, what Chazal are teaching us is that's what Rav Zacharia ben Avkalos was doing. Yes, I mean it. Making a mess. By not deciding, by not taking a strong halachic stance, by reverting to passivity, we already see one of the problems of the response of leadership at that time, and that is simply to be passive. So you tell me, what are Chazal telling us about conflict and passivity? Shall we retreat into anvatanut? Absolutely not. That is not the response that is going to yield any positive results. So let's continue then with another leader that we know from the generation, namely Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And we're going to see Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's very interesting religious and political stance with regard to different ideas that we find throughout Ch'as. So firstly, one of his famous statements in Pirkei Avot, Tuaya Omer, Im lamadata Torah harbe, al tachazik tova latzmacha, ki lekach notzarta. If you learn a lot of Torah, don't think you're so wonderful, because that's why you were created. What is he saying then about his persona of Torah? He is not so great as a Talmud scholar. Talmudic scholars, Torah sages, yes, they should be respected, but they shouldn't necessarily think that they are and that they are the gift to society, because that's what they're supposed to be doing. They are simply fulfilling their responsibility. In other words, he recognizes in a society wherein there are parlor meetings for the rabbis hosted by the bourgeoisie, he understands that how do rabbis now see themselves? As the elitist class together with the wealthy patrons. And therefore, he says, don't let the money get to your head, because you were created. You're supposed to learn Torah whether or not you're going to be funded for it. And we're going to see how essential this is as we see Rabbi Yochanan's stances, firstly, as he fights against the Tzedukim. For example, source number 5, the Tosefta and Masechet Parah, shows us that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to become known not so much for how people remember him as paving a new path post-destruction, but rather for saving the people from both a religious and absolute dissemination at a time of a national crisis. For example, during his time period, we know of the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, who not only infiltrated within the kuhuna, the priestly positions, but very much saw themselves as the ones who were properly transmitting the traditions of earlier generations. So one of the interesting halachot that they derived from the text is that when one wants to become tahor, all one has to do to become pure is to wait until sunset. But we know that there's something else that's required for the transition from impurity to purity, namely mikvah. Excellent. Maaseh achat sheheriv shimsho. There was a case where the sunset, uval lestrof et hapara. So the tzeduki kohen at the time said, excellent, all we have to do now for this person who is tamei lamit is to undergo the process of sprinkling him with the ashes of the para aduma. V'yadabo Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as a Torah leader of the generation, heard of this, and he heard that this kohen was going to begin the process of purification without the kohen having immersed. Uva v'samach shtei yadav alav. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai puts his hands directly on the kohen, v'amar lo ishi kohen gadol. Ma na'at aliyot kohen gadol. Tzvol yom achad yarad v'taval v'ala. He says, oh, how wonderful it is that you have the zchut to be the kohen gadol. But now I just want you to know that my hands were impure. So what did I just do when I placed my hands upon you? I defiled you officially. So now what do you have to do? Now I have to go and immerse. You would think that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai should have some sense of victory right now. The triumph is not complete. Because after this Kohen Gadol got up from immersing, Tzaram lo bo'ozno, Rav Yochanan ripped his ear. Amar lo ben Zakkai, l'ksheef nelecha, amar lo kshitzi paneh. The Kohen Gadol turned and he said, I'm going to get back at you, because what did Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai just do to this Sadducee Kohen? He just defiled him long-term and permanently as a Kohen Gadol by defiling him through the blemish of the ear. But isn't that interesting? We spoke about the eye. We spoke about a blemish of the lips. What's the problem of the blemish of the ear? He's saying, you have a problem listening. I'm trying to teach you. I thought you would get the message that you are really an improper Kohen. But obviously you didn't hear well. So I'm going to cause a blemish of your ear. Anna, the Kohen, says, I'm going to get back at you. What does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say? Okay, one day you'll get back at me. Lo and behold, lo shahash lo shah yamim, ad shenitanuha bekever. Within 3 days, this Kohen had died. Who gets the last word? Not just Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but his father, who comes and he says, wow, you were right when you said that he's going to end up dying. So we see that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai initially did try to fight against the tide. He tried to fight against the tzedukim. He tried to fight against the improper kohanim. And we're going to see in the next source that he also tried to fight against the internal strife. He tried to fight against the biryonim, the zealots of the time who were tearing apart society. The last 4 or 5 years before the Khorban, what are known as the years of the Great Rebellion, wherein factors of society, members who are not as wealthy as the patrons, who feel very much oppressed financially, both by the Romans and by other Jews. So how are they going to fight? By arousing the wrath of everyone against the wealthy classes. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tries to stop their actions as well. Another famous story told of his own nephew. We'll look at the English now at the bottom of the page, source number 6. Abba Sikra, who was the head of the Biryonim in Yerushalayim, was the son of the sister of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sent to him saying, come to me and visit me privately, because I don't want to get in trouble meeting with you, and you don't want to get in trouble meeting with me. When he came, he said to him, how long are you going to carry on this way and kill the people with starvation? He replied, what can I do? If I say something to them, then they will kill me. What were the Biryonim, what were the zealots doing in Yerushalayim at the time? They were burning storehouses. Somewhat so, the Chazal say that the three wealthy patrons whom we saw, Kalba Savua, Naktimon Ben-Gurion, and Ben Titit HaKesef, they all offered on their own, when they knew that Yerushalayim was under threat of siege, they all offered to donate water cisterns and wine and oil and wood for the fire to ensure that Yerushalayim would be able to survive. Chazal say that they had enough supplies to last 21 years. What happened? The Biryonim burnt it all down. And as we know, unfortunately, within even just a few weeks, and everything was ultimately destroyed. He says, what can I do? If I say something to these zealots, they'll kill me. He said, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, then that's it. Devise for me a way to escape. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai realizes that if even within a party, if even one of the zealots tries to speak reason with the other zealots, that he'd be killed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai realizes, then there is no hope. Then there's no hope for any reconciliation. Then there's no hope for me preaching. Then there's no hope for my Torah. Then there's no hope for the future of the city of Yerushalayim. And this is what we see as response number two. Sometimes, when one is in a state of crisis, when one is witnessing destruction, at times we try to fight against it, and we try to at least thwart the process, or at least try to slow down the process. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, sometimes we have to be honest enough to realize that we can't make a difference, in which case we have to begin forging a new path, a place for the future of all the refugees who are going to leave Yerushalayim. So he says, it's time for me to leave. And at first glance, and we'll see how Chazal really debate this, it may seem as if Chazal are applauding surrender. And they're telling us, yes, sometimes we have to wave the white flag, but we're going to look at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and we're going to see that he, in a very relentless manner, is not going to give up hope. Rather, he's going to place his hope in a different literal geographic place, but also recognizing the need to respond to the helplessness and hopelessness of the time. He says, maybe I can do something to save a little. So his nephew recommends, the only way to get you out of the city, because no one wants the Torah scholar to leave the city, pretend to be ill, let everyone ask about you, pretend then, bring something evil smelling, put it by you so that they will all say that you're dead. Then your disciples will get under your bed so that they shall not notice. And they will then take you and take you out as a corpse from the city. He did so. His students, Rabbi Eliezer, went on one side, Rabbi Yoshua on the other. When they reached the door, and some say when they reached the guards wanted to put a cherub right through them. And he said, but then the Romans are going to say, look at the disrespect that you're showing my master. They wanted to push him. He said, then they're going to say that you pushed this great Torah scholar. So they opened a new town gate for him, and he got out. When he reached the Romans, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, peace to you, O king, O king. But at that point, Aspasianus Vespasian was merely a procurator of the Romans. He wasn't any emperor or king. He says, if I'm king, then why have you not come to me before now? He says, because you're saying you're not king. You're not king yet, but you will be king. And that's why I didn't come to you until now. He continues, and at that very moment, a messenger comes to Vespasian and says, you are now king. So after a very interesting discussion as to how Vespasian gets his shoes on and off, we then continue with the bolded words. Vespasian said, I am now going and I will send someone to take my place as procurator. You can, however, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, make a request of me and I will grant it. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asks for the following. He says the famous words, Tein li, Yavne v'chachameha. Give me Yavne, give me the family chain of the Nisiyut, of the princely family of Ramban Gamliel, and give me physicians to heal Rabbi Tzadok. That's the end of Rabbi Yochanan's request, which we know all three were taken care of. But then we find a post facto comment. Rabbi Yosef, and some even say Rabbi Akiva, a generation and two later, apply this pasuk and they say, shame on Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. That was the improper response. If he really had hope, what should he have asked for? Give me Yerushalayim. Let me save Yerushalayim. Instead, he asked for Yavne, which is under Roman auspices. This was Hatzalah Porta. This was just a small salvation that he provided for, whereas he could have provided for so much more. However, others say, no, this is all that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could have asked for. He himself was fraught with this dilemma and didn't know till his dying day how he's going to approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Could I have asked for more? Should I have asked for more? Or maybe this really is all that I could have said. We continue with the story and see that Rabbi Tzadok was deathly ill at the time, and yet they managed to heal him. And we're going to speak a little bit more of Rabbi Tzadok very soon. But now let's take a look at source number 7, where we're going to see another story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, wherein when Aspasianus actually comes to destroy Yerushalayim, according to this source, Rabbi Yochanan waited to the very last minute. He didn't give up right away. He really did try to teach Torah, to improve the character of the people. He tried to show them that they shall not be necessarily dependent on the wealthy people and the Romans in society. But notice this very last story. Aspasianus Vespasian is coming to destroy Yerushalayim. Amar lahem shotim mipnei ma'atem mevakshim la'achriv et ha'ir hazot. He turns to the zealots and the internal conflicts within the city and he says, don't you realize that you are self-destructing? That you are the ones who are causing the destruction of the city? You're so silly. Va'atem mevakshim lesrof et beit ha'mikdash. He says, all I want to know is that you're not going to rebel against the Romans. So I'll tell you what. And Ela Shetishabruli Keshatachat. So send me, the city is under siege, he says, send me a white flag. Send me one arrow. Or Chetachat, Ve'elech li mikem. Show me a sign of surrender, and I won't destroy Yerushalayim. And I won't destroy the Beit HaMikdash. What do the Jews inside say? No, just like we won previous victories, Vaharaganum, this is referring to a famous battle of Beit Horon, where they warded off the Roman forces. They said we can ward them off again and ultimately reestablish independence in Yerushalayim. In the meantime, who comes on the scene? Fourth line came, Vashya Shama, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai heard that the people still have a chance of saving Yerushalayim. Shalach the karalan she Yerushalayim v'amar lahem banai mepnei ma atem machrivim et ha'ir hazot. Why are you causing the destruction of the city? Ma'atem mevakshim lesrof et beit ha'mikdash v'chi mahu mevakesh mikem. He's just asking you for you to recognize that you have to surrender. That yes, we are no longer going to hold on to autonomy in the city. So we may as well at least survive. We may as well not lose the beit ha'mikdash. But the people said no. At that point, Vespasian comes with all of his forces until they reach Sha'arei Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai becomes the epitome of a leader who really does have hope, but up to a certain point. He becomes the paradigm of someone who responds to the crisis in Yerushalayim by trying everything he can, but up to a certain point, and then says, I'm giving up here. I'm giving up on the status quo. I'm giving up on the present situation. But what do I still have hope in? I know that there's a future. So instead of investing in the present, I'm going to invest in the future. That's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. But don't think that even when we forfeit the situation in the present and focus on the future, don't think that we don't mourn the destruction of the present. After all, source number 8 tells us that pam achad haya Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai yotzei miYerushalayim, vaya Rabbi Yoshua olech acharav. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who is already safe and secure in Yavne, he sees the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, makom shemachaprim bo avanoteihem shel Yisrael, amar lo bni, al yera lecha. Here Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I know it looks really bad, my son, my Talmid. I know that you are witness to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. I know you're thinking there's no way that we can go on in the future because there's no means of atonement anymore. But no, Rabbi Yoshua, yesh lanu kapara achat shehi kmota. We have something that's parallel to the Beit HaMikdash. And this is a remarkable statement. What does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say? He says, don't lose hope. Don't think that the present is all gone. What do we still have? Ezozeh, what's comparable to the atonement achieved through bringing sacrifices in the Beit HaMikdash? Gemilut chasadim, shenamar ki chasad chafatzti velo zavach. At this point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want our sacrifices anymore. What does he truly want? He says what he wanted all along. And that is for you to work on your social contract. That is for you to work on your character. That is for you to stop, finally, the internal strife. And as he looks back at Yerushalayim in source number 9, he at the same time, though, can also mourn the past. As he hears that Yerushalayim is captured, Yoshev umitzapeh v'chared. He sits and he observes and he shakes k'neged makom shaya eli Yoshev umitzapeh. How do Chazal see Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai as a parallel character to
Eli HaKohen, who also has to witness the Churban, who recognized as he looks and sees the burning of Mishkan Shiloh, he knows 100% why is it happening? Because his own sons, Hophni and Pinchas, were extremely corrupt. And he recognizes that maybe he didn't do enough to stop them. That's the despair of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, to know when to throw the towel in, to know that there is a certain time where we do have to say, enough, we can't change the situation. Let us invest our resources in providing a future for Am Yisrael. But that doesn't mean that he's happy with this. After all, he's going to say with Libo Chared al Aron Halukim, Kevan Sheshama Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai Shechriv et Yerushalayim, just like Eli, who fell backwards out of fear and out of anxiety when he heard that the Aron Hashem was taken, so to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he hears that the destruction of Yerushalayim, the Saraf et Beit HaMikdash, Ba'ish, Kara B'Gadav, he tears his clothing, V'karu Talmidav et Bigdehem, V'yu Bochim, V'tzoakim, V'softim. There is what to mourn. We mourn our losses, our personal losses, and our national losses. L'kol Zman V'et L'kol Chefetz, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai understands there are times. There are times that we realize that the situation is so difficult that all we can do is mourn, but at the same time, try to transplant, try to foresee a future for Am Yisrael, create an alternate method wherein they will actually work on themselves. His task, he realizes, is to now figure out a new plan, to prepare the ground for the absorption of all the exiles once they survive the war. Which brings us to another interesting character. And notice that I gave him very little space because the Gemara hardly mentions him. And this is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who technically is the continued leader of the princely clan of Nesiim, the head of the Sanhedrin, the legislative body during that time, a direct descendant of Hillel HaZaken, of Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, who created the calendar, who was very active in Har HaBayit when the Beit HaMikdash was standing. And yet, we hardly have any statements of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel the first. We have Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel the second of the Usha generation mentioned throughout Shas. But one statement that we do have of him in the Sechad Avot, what does he say? Shimon b'no shel Rabban Gamliel omer, kol yamai gadalti ben hachachamim, I grew up with these chachamim, v'lo matzati laguf tov ela shtika. Our sense is, what was Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel's response to the political arena? Not necessarily the same humility and passivity of Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkalos, but quiet. He recognized, I don't know what to say. But what's interesting is that in the life of Josephus' own autobiography, he explains that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel originally took a nonpartisan stance. But at a certain point, what happened to him? He joined the Bir Yomim. He joined the Zealots. He realized, if you can't fight them, then you join them. And he joined them and henceforth was murdered by the Romans, which we recite in Eila Eskara, Arzei HaLevanon, the death of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel together with Rabbi Yishmael, that his death was seen as one that for that time period ended the generation of the Nesiim, and that's why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has to make sure that it continues with his son, with Rabban Gamliel Hasheni in Yavne. But we turn now to the last, to the third response, which I know sounds a little strange when you look at carpets and comfort, and I don't necessarily mean the plushness thereof, but rather the stories that Chazal are going to tell us with regard to what one should do in responding to Churban. We see that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's position, both himself, he's going to experience an internal dialectic, not knowing whether he responded properly or not, and certainly, even later rabbis who saw the success in Yavne, Rabbi Akiva himself, who cast some doubt over whether or not Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai responded in a significantly forceful manner, we're going to see that everyone agrees, including Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that Rabbi Tzadok's reaction is perhaps the one that we should truly espouse at a time of any national Churban. We begin with story number one, our first exposure to Rabbi Tzadok, who wasn't just the leader of the generation of sages, but also one of the Kohanim. He lived on Har HaBayit. This was his identity. And yet a tragic story takes place years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Ma'aseh b'shnei kohanim shayu rotzin v'olim b'kevesh. Two kohanim, who because the priestly position became a coveted one of honor and not necessarily significant in its content, everyone wanted the honor of throwing the different parts of the korbanot on the Mizbeach. Two kohanim were running up so that they could be the first to throw the Ivarim on top of the fire. And what happened? As they were running up the ramp at the same time, one of them pushed the other, and some say he didn't actually push him, he stabbed the other. Natal sakin v'takalo bilibo. And he stabbed him where? Now notice this picture, by the way. The stabbing is on the way to throwing the parts of the korban on top of the mizbeach. In other words, this is our official, literal, first korban. He becomes a sacrifice on top of the ramp. Then Rabbi Tzadok is the first one to respond. Ba Rabbi Tzadok va'amad al ma'alot ha'olam. Rabbi Tzadok got up and he stood on the stairs of the Beit HaMikdash. What happens on the stairs of the Beit HaMikdash? Do you remember? The Levim sing their songs. Beautiful. And the Kohanim stand with their hands outstretched saying a bracha like Yevarecha Hashem v'yishmerecha yehar Hashem panav eilecha v'chunecha yisa Hashem panav eilecha v'yaseim lecha shalom. He says, look at what has happened to these stairs of peace. V'amar shimuni achenu beit Yisrael. He says, this is terrible, my brothers. Harei hu omer ki yimatzei halal. We know that when there is a case of a halal, of a dead body that's unidentified between two cities, the elders of the closer city have to come and they have to bring a korban to absolve themselves of the guilt. He says, so now let's see who is really responsible for this death. He is using the figurative halachot of the Egla Arufa to say, let's see who should take responsibility. Who bears responsibility for this death? And notice, who does he cry out to? The Skinim, the Shoftim, the Kohanim. Who should bring the karban for the Hechal? Oh, Allah Azarot. And he starts to cry and to cry. And he recognizes that what he can do is to try to show the people a reflection of themselves. Look how terrible this is. It is time that you step up and bear some level of responsibility. So initially, they all follow Rabbi Tzadok. They all cry. Here's a person who clearly is respected, a person of integrity, a person of eminence. And yet we find that slowly but surely, as Rabbi Tzadok is witness to all the strife that we've seen in the previous stories, he's going to withdraw. He withdraws his involvement in communal affairs because just like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he realizes at a certain time that he's not affecting the people. And instead, we're going to see he begins to live a life of ascetic solitude. And this is very sad because we're going to see some statements from his son, Rabbi Elazar bar Rabbi Tzadok, who mentions that he remembers as a young child, as a little Kohen, riding on his father's shoulders as his father skipped all the way to the Beit HaMikdash, showing his excitement to be part of not only the religious zeitgeist, the religious spirit, but also the social zeitgeist of the time. And he says that same Rabbi Elazar bar Rabbi Tzadok is going to comment on how his father withdrew from religious life, withdrew from political life out of despair, but at the same time, in order to show the people that that's what they have to do. They have to take a step back and recognize themselves. So we're now going to engage in the last few Midrashei Chorban, some of which you probably have seen before, but you're going to see that the common denominator is the same in all of these Midrashim, and interestingly, the character of Rabbi Tzadok is there to comment. He serves as our social and religious op-ed piece. He's going to be there as our commentator to explain what was going on. He says, I wasn't ready like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to give up on the people. I was really hoping that if they would see just how far they have deteriorated, then maybe they can recognize and pick themselves up on their own. So let's examine the first story of his commentary, source number 12, M'sikta Rabati, Maaseh b'Miriam bito shel Nakdimon. Do you remember Nakdimon? Very wealthy man, patron of Yerushalayim. This is a story of his daughter, Shaita Shomeret Yaban. She had lost her husband and she was waiting to marry the brother of the deceased. Uvata itzel Rabbi Tzadok. But in the meantime, she needs to live off of something. So she goes to Rabbi Tzadok, who apparently was the one to write up her ketubah, and she demands for the payment of her ketubah, of the dowry. Upasakla, chaf he litrot shel kesef. And based on her ketubah, how much is she going to receive? 25 liters of silver. Then we don't know exactly how much this is. That Professor Daniel Sperber explains that this is close to $250,000. Yana lekupat besamim, just for her perfume needs. Lemezonoteha, v'satayim yayin letavshileha, v'chol shabbat v'shabbat. This is how much she's going to be rewarded on a weekly basis. He says, okay, I will make sure you receive this amount. What's her response? Amralo, kach tifzeku levnotechem, would you give such a meager amount to your daughters? And Rabbi Tzadok is probably looking at the Talmidei Chachamim saying, halavai, that we could afford this to give our daughters. Ukshehigia ha-ra'av, but when the Biryonim destroyed all the storehouses of Nakdimon and all the other residents of Yerushalayim, nashar sa'ara min ha-ra'av, out of starvation, she began to lose her hair. Ve'ra'a ota Rabbi Tzadok shaita misavivet imaviha b'shuk. And Rabbi Tzadok saw her going around with her father in the shuk. This is a reference to the slave market, where hundreds and thousands of Jews are being sold for cheap prices every day to the Romans, as recorded by Josephus. Amar hi, otam Miriam shepasata la kach bakach v'shabbat v'kelela etchem. And he sees her and he recognizes, oh my, that's the Miriam who demanded so much money, who cursed us. Amar Rabbi Tzadok, I can't believe it. I can't believe that I have seen her now collecting barley from animal dung. And now I apply the midrash. I'm applying the pasuk in Shir Hashirim, a beautiful pasuk that describes the love between the male persona and the female persona when he encourages her and invites her. He says, come join me. Come and disguise yourself as a shepherdess and follow the footsteps of the flock. Follow the footsteps of the young goats. And what is he saying? Shame on you, Miriam. You should have, at the time of Shir HaShirim, at a time of love, at a time when things were still relatively okay for Am Yisrael, you should have followed in the footsteps of the flock. You should have recognized the rest of Am Yisrael. You should have followed them and been a little more sensitive to the poorer classes. Because had you done that, what would have happened? Had you only followed them then you wouldn't be following the animal dung now. Shame on you, Miriam. Tzi'ilach bi'ikveh hatzon. You should have followed the people. You should have been more sensitive to the people. And obviously, Rabbi Tzadok, as opposed here to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who says, I'm trying to teach Torah, I'm trying to tell people that it's not the ostentatious nature of their parlor meetings that makes the difference of whether or not Torah study is going to be perpetuated. It's their character. Shame on them. Rabbi Tzadok says, don't leave, don't give up on the people, give them a chance. Give them a chance of recognizing how they have to be sensitive to the other members of Am Yisrael. Because if not, then they in fact will suffer. A very similar story then in source number 13. Maaseh b'Miriam b'toshel Nakdimon, another story of Miriam, of Martha, shehaita melaketet tzorim mibein talfei hasusim. This seems to be more or less another version. She's collecting barley from the dung, this time of horses. Amar Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok, Erebe Nechama, im lo ri'itiha melaketet tzorim mibein talfei hasusim ba'ako. Oh my, the same woman who once had such beautiful hair, now she's collecting everything from the dung of the horses. He says another midrash, Al tikri gediotayach. Instead of reading it as following the rest of Am Yisrael, following the flock, read it as gediotayach. Now you're following the corpses that are being taken out of the city under siege. Now you're seeing the poverty and the famine-stricken people, Martha, the ones that you have become a part of, as the dead bodies leave Yerushalayim. But perhaps the story that is going to show us not only the leaders of the generation, but particularly Rabbi Tzadok's critical commentary at the time, is source number 14. Maaseh ben Miriam bat Baitos. So here we have another Martha. All the Miriams, don't worry. Generally, this is a nice name. But Miriam here, and perhaps she's even confused with Miriam bat Nachtimon. There are different versions of the story. But another Miriam bat Baitos, very wealthy woman from the Baitos priestly classes. Shekitsha Yehoshua ben Gamla. Wow, this already tells us she definitely has to be amongst the bourgeoisie, because who's Mesader Kiddushin for her? The leader of the educational movement, educational reform, Rabbi Yeshua ben Gamla. Uminahu hamelech liyot kohen gadol. Even though this seems like a very simplistic statement, this is rather complex. This is a story of Miriam bat Baitos, Shekitsha, Yehoshua ben Gamla, wasn't the Mesader Kiddushin. He himself became Mekudeshet. He sanctified Miriam bat Baitos. Uminahu hamelech liyot kohen gadol. And then the king made him Kohen Gadol. In other words, why did the king make him Kohen Gadol? Because now this Talmud Chacham is engaged to a wealthy woman. So now that he has Yichus, what can we do? Now we can appoint him to a position of power, telling you how corrupt the position of Kohuna Gadola has become. But notice all the more, it doesn't say Umino HaMelech Liyot Kohen, but the Kohen Gadol. Once Miriam bat Baitos was Mekudeshet. In other words, some even explain that she was married beforehand, which also leaves us with a problem of a Kohen Gadol, but that's the least of our problems. Namely, that the father said, okay, you can sanctify my wealthy daughter, but you cannot marry her until you, who even though you're a wonderful Talmud Chacham, you haven't really risen in the ranks of society. So once you're already engaged to her, then I'm going to make sure that you become the Kohen Gadol, and then you can marry my daughter. So now we hear, wow, what yichus. He has a son-in-law who is a Kohen Gadol. V'nechnesa pam achat lir'ot. V'amra elech ve'aro'oto k'shu korei b'yom ha-kipurim. Wow, Miriam's husband is not only a Talmud Chacham, but also the Kohen Gadol. And she says, you know, maybe I should go once to see him. In other words, how often does she frequent the Beit HaMikdash? Never. And she says, but, you know, it's the right thing to do. So you tell me, when would be the best day to go and see your husband, the Kohen Gadol, in the peak of his performance?
Yom Kippur.
On Yom Kippur. When? What is the holiest moment?
When he enters the Kodesh
Kodeshim, and then ultimately
when he exits
for the last time, right? When he comes out of the Kodesh Kodeshim the fifth time to remove the last of the kelim, and that's when everyone sings. Well, today we sing Gana Mare Kohen. When everyone is able to appreciate, look at this Kohen Gadol, who on his face we see the reflection of the Shekhinah. Right? Aren't you excited that here she's finally going to see her husband at the peak of his spiritual glory? So I'm sorry to disappoint you. She says, She says, I know when I'll see him, not when he comes out of the Kodesh Kodashim. That's quite trivial. Rather, when he's reading the Sefer Torah, and around the Musaf time, between Musaf and Mincha, when he's reading the Sefer Torah, where does he read the Sefer Torah? In the Azara, in front of all of Am Yisrael. In other words, what is she looking forward to? Not his spiritual level. She's looking forward to seeing him
perform
in his moments of glory in front of everyone of Am Yisrael. And she's going to say, that's my husband. That's right. So what does she do, though? Oh, but it's Yom Kippur, and I can't wear my leather sandals for the Beit HaMikdash. Keeping in mind that Kohanim, I'm sure you're familiar with this from visiting the burnt house, the Kohanim, the corrupt Kohanim during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, all lived in very close proximity, again, with their stone houses to the Beit HaMikdash. So she's just a few feet away, but what does she say? Oh, I can't have my feet trample on the dirty floor. So instead, Hotziula taftiot mi petach beita at petach Beit HaMikdash. She has her Jewish slave roll out carpets. This is where the carpets come in. She has them roll out carpets on Yom HaKippurim so that Chas V'Shalom, her feet, should not touch the floor and get dirty. Kedei shelo yitchafu ragleha. V'yafal pichen, nityachafu ragleha. Nonetheless, you can't help it. Of course, there's going to be a little bit of dirt that does come on her feet. Notice, by the way, how many of you have been in Yerushalayim on Yom Kippur? Like, what's the weather like?
Hot.
That's it. That's right. Notice this. On Yom Kippur, because she wants to see her husband in public glory, and because she cannot have her feet get dirty on Yom Kippur, what is she going to do? She's going to have Jews spend their Yom Kippur rolling out the red carpets for her. She's going to have Jews sweating in their soily clothing. Hannah, as she walks to the Beit HaMikdash. And with this, we find the end. Paskula chachamim satayim yayim b'chol yom. When her husband Yoshua died, she also received a very, very large ketubah. Tanya ein poskim yayim isha, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba amar, l'shem znut, kama da'amar in Sefer Hosea. And now what happens to Miriam at the end? This very, very wealthy woman, Amar Rabbi Elazar bar Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Elazar, quoting again his father, Rabbi Tzadok, Do you want to know what happened to this Miriam? But by Tos, Shekashru Sa'arotaha Bizinvesu Sehem, the Romans tied her hair to, or it's not even clear if it's the Romans or the Zealots, who tied her hair to the tails of horses, Shelarvim Vayu Maritzimlam Yerushalayim Va'ad Lod, the Karati Allah Pasuka Harachabach Vahanuga. What happened to you, O dainty, O fairest of women? The woman who wouldn't let her clean feet on Yom Kippur touch the ground, what happened to her? In the end, she was dragged on the ground by her hair. By the hair and by the horses, the Arabian horses. Because she herself, what Rabbi Tzadok is saying is, look, I'm trying to teach you what leads you to this situation. I'm trying to get you to see yourselves. And to see your own stubbornness and your own lack of sensitivity towards the other classes of Am Yisrael. And now one of the last stories then, Martha bat Baitus atirata Yerushalayim. Another story that tells us the ends of Martha bat Baitus. One version that she's dragged through the same streets that she refuses to step on. But now source number 15, Martha, the daughter of Baitus, was one of the richest women in Yerushalayim. We've already corroborated that. She sent her servant saying, go and bring me some fine flour. By the time he went, it was all sold out. He came and he told her there was no fine flour, but there was white flour. She said to him, go and bring me some. By the time he went, he found the white flour sold out. So he came and he said, there's no white flour, but there's dark flour. You would think by now, what should the servant do?
Buy
whatever there is. Why doesn't he? Because he knows that she's in charge. He takes orders from Martha and from nobody else. Anna, he can't even think on his own because he knows that if he comes back with something, she'll say, you didn't listen to me. That's not what I told you to do. She said, okay, now bring me the dark flour. By the time he went, it was sold out. He returned and said, there's no dark flour. There's barley flour. Go bring me some. By the time he goes back, it was also sold out because of her stubbornness. In the end, she's going to starve. By then, she had taken off her shoes. The same woman who will not let her feet get dirty on the ground, takes off her own shoes, and she says, I will go out to the market myself and see if I can find anything to eat. Some dung got stuck to her foot, and because of her dainty nature, she died. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai says, that's what happens when you're a little too fair, when you're a little too delicate, when you won't put your feet on the ground, when instead you stomp on other people like your own servants and your own brethren living in Yerushalayim. And some say that how did she die? Not from the dung. She died because she ate part of a fig left over by, here's our leader again, Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok, who would fast for 40 days and 40 nights, trying to change the situation from within, so that ultimately, when he would eat, people could see the food through his emaciated bones. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for such a strange request. Provide not only the hope for the future, don't just provide me Yavne v'chachameha. Don't just assure the perpetuation of the patriarchal line of Nisiyut through Rabban Gamliel, but I also want Rabbi Tzadok to be healed, he tells Vespasian. Make sure that there are more Rabbi Tzadoks. And sure enough, when they go to seek out Rabbi Tzadok, they can't find him. He's deathly ill. And they go seeking him out until finally he's found, and little by little they nurse him back to health. And Vespasian turns to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and he says, pardon me, dear Rabbi. He doesn't use this exact terminology, but he says, then why is this sickly man so important to you? And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, because had there only been some more Rabbi Tzadoks, Yerushalayim would have been saved. You would not have been able to penetrate the walls of Yerushalayim. You would not have been able to penetrate the thick society. You would not have been able to penetrate the character of Am Yisrael. Rabbi Tzadok is trying to let us see ourselves. He is presenting himself as the mirror of Am Yisrael, walking around as a microcosmic Chorban, in order to show Am Yisrael, look what has happened to you. You, who have destroyed yourselves, who have destroyed your sensitivity one to the other, through the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, through not speaking when you should speak and speaking when you shouldn't, through looking at each other improperly, for being selfish when money meant something to you, all but a social status. For that, he says, this is the Chorban that you're experiencing, but if you can only change your ways. And therefore, Rabbi Tzadok, yes, he represents on one hand the crisis of the carpets, but he also represents for us a tremendous amount of hope as well. And even though we see in source number 16 that he somewhat reconciles himself after the Chorban, at the same time, he's still frustrated. A story is told of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Tzadok, Shayu Mesubim Bebeit HaMishteh. And they were all sitting down to drink wine. Beno Shel Ramban Gamliel, Ena Weta, Gena Rambana Gamliel, Vahaya Ramban Gamliel, Omed Omashke Alehem. And who else was there? The Nasi at the time. And the Nasi is serving the Talmidei Chachamim. And when he gets up to serve Rabbi Eliezer says, no, I can't have you serve me. And Rabbi Yoshua says, no, it's okay, you can serve me. For after all, Avram Avinu, who's greater than Avram Avinu? He served his Arab guests, so yes, it's okay for you to serve me. And Rabbi Eliezer says, what do you mean? He's the Nasi. How can you have him serve you? And Rabbi Tzadok says, enough. The third line from the bottom of Surah 16, Ad matay atem menichim kvodo shel makom, v'atem oskin b'chvod habriyot. He says, I don't understand you. You're engaged in such trivial conversation. He should serve you wine. He shouldn't serve you wine. That we're living post-Chorban. What should you be concerned with? I think a few more lofty manners, he says. Like HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Again, after all, he's Meshiv Ruchot, Maleh Nisiyim, Morid Matar, Matzmiach Adama, Orech Shulchan, Lefnei Kol Achad Ve'achad. Va'anu, Lo Yeh Ramban Gamliel, Berebi Yomeda Mashke Aleinu. He says, that's your biggest problem. Having Ramban Gamliel serve us, you're thinking of the status of Ramban Gamliel. He says, but that's the problem. Everything becomes a status symbol. If you learned anything from the Chorban Beit HaMikdash, what should that be? Who should our status symbol be? We should be looking over our shoulders. Who's receiving more kavod? We should be looking atop of our shoulders and granting that kavod, that respect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But on a more hopeful ending, Rabbi Tzadok himself recognizes that as difficult as this is, he also is going to seek some hope as well. He himself is going to end, as we see in the Tosefta. It says in the name of Rabbi Lazar ben Tzadok, it took a while, but my father reached the stage, Hayamit Palot Bilak Tzara Ba'arve Shabbatot. He would say the following bracha on Erev Shabbat. Says, even though there are different versions of abridgments of Shmona Esrei, and if one is walking on the way, he says, this was my father's bracha. On Shabbat, he would say, U'me'avatcha Hashem Elokeinu. Hashem, we appreciate that you gave us Shabbat as an expression of your love for us. And he would say on the coast, Asher Kidesh et Yom HaShabbat. Rabbi Tzadok in the end says, we have to go on. And we have to go on without a Beit HaMikdash. And as opposed to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who says, we still have Gemilut Chasadim, Rabbi Tzadok recognizes, yes, and we still have Shabbat. We have a day, we have a microcosm of Me'ein Olam Haba. We have a time that reminds us of the way the world is supposed to be. And I'm always reminded, whenever I see this sugya, that it says, the last part is, Ve'eino Chotem, but he wouldn't end the bracha. I'm reminded of a story of my next-door neighbor, whose father was in the Shoah, Rabbi Manuel. And when he was in the Shoah, his mother, who had risked her life on Shabbat by not writing down, she was a stenographer in the camps, and she refused on Shabbat to write down more than what was necessary. So even when she had the opportunity to defend herself, she wouldn't defend. She said, I don't want anyone to write down, to type down more than what's necessary on Shabbat. And she was put in isolation, and her son tried to nurse her back to health, and it was over Pesach, and her son is reading to her the Haggadah, and he reaches the bracha, Ava Ga'al Yisrael, Baruch Atah Hashem Asher Ga'alanu, and thank you Hashem for all the geulot, for all the redemptions of the past, Asher Ga'alanu V'Ga'alat Avotenu, and yet he can't finish the bracha. Says he couldn't finish the bracha of Ga'al Yisrael in the middle of the Shoah, in the middle of a state of crisis. And then 20 years later, when he is serving as a tzaddik, must be more than 20, 25, 30 years later, serving as a tzaddik for his grandson's bris in Yerushalayim, he announces, he says the bracha, after the bracha, Borei Pri HaGafen, and he says, now I can officially give a chatima. Now I can offer the bracha of Ga'al Yisrael. He said, had I only known then, in the barracks of Auschwitz, that there would be a time that I would have a son and that I would raise a grandson in the streets of Yerushalayim, then I would have been able to grant a chatima. Rabbi Tzadok lives in the present and deals with the issues of the present. And he recognizes that Am Yisrael have destroyed themselves, but he doesn't leave them for the future. He stays with them in the present, hoping that they will change themselves. And therefore, he can't end his bracha. He can't end the bracha of Kedushat Shabbat because he still feels that sense of forlorn. Bachazal tell us, but it's okay. It's okay for Rabbi Tzadok to stay and to reconcile himself with the little bit of peace, with that piece of Shabbat that remains with us. But how do the rest of us continue to move on? On one hand, we look at these three leaders. We look at rabbinic responses to Chorban, and we recognize that Chazal are clearly criticizing passivity. And they debate with regard to whether or not we give up on the present for the sake of the future. And they are clearly lauding Rabbi Tzadok for his attempts and his commentary of trying to have Am Yisrael change themselves, of educating the generation. But now we're going to see one last story, a story that teaches all of us how we're supposed to live, how we're supposed to respond to Chorban. That like Rabbi Tzadok, we're not supposed to give up on society. And even when everything looks bleak, we see the story of Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi, the Braita says of him, Pam achat hayiti malech b'derech, v'nechnasti l'chorba achad mi'chorbot Yerushalayim. I was walking amongst the ruins of Yerushalayim. I saw what the destruction had caused, and I went to daven in one of the ruins. And you can just imagine, why do you think Rabbi Yossi was adamant about davening in a chorba of Yerushalayim? He wanted to appeal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He wanted to separate himself from the rest of society. He wanted to continue mourning over Yerushalayim. He saw himself, like Rabbi Tzadok, as part of the Chorban. Va Eliyahu zachor latov, but Eliyahu HaNavi came. V'shamar li ala petach. And he was watching me by, or waiting at the door till I finished my tefillah. And after I finished my tefillah, he said to me, Lachar shesiyamti amar li shalom alecha, Rabbi, peace be unto you. And he said to me, my son, why did you go into this room? And I said, well, isn't it obvious to pray? He said, shame on you. You should have prayed on the road. And I said, no, because what would have happened on the road? There would have been too many interruptions. Passers-by might interrupt me. So he said, if that's the case, then you should have, it would have been preferable to offer a tzvilah kitzara, an abbreviated prayer. He says, that's when I learned three things. I learned that you shouldn't go into a ruin. What is Rabbi Yossi teaching us? How to avoid occupational hazards? Rabbi Yossi is teaching us you shouldn't live in that state of Chorban. You shouldn't remain static. When you see Chorban, you have to respond to it. And how do you respond? Not by isolating yourself from society aesthetically. Rather, you're supposed to go out, says Eliyahu, and even if there are distractions, and even if you're not going to remain on the same spiritual level, go out to the people. Go out betol ha'ir. Go to the streets. Stay with the people. Try to affect the people. Work within Am Yisrael. Work within society. He says, and that's when I learned that I really should have done that. I should have forfeited my own very special tefillah and instead pray on the road. He then said to me, but Rabbi Yose, when you were in the ruin, what sound, what voice did you hear in the ruin? He said, I heard a divine voice, like a dove that said, Shame on Yerushalayim. Shame on the people. I heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu relating to me, almost admitting, yes, Rabbi Yose, you're right. The people don't deserve that I should come to them. But Eliyahu says, but that's strange. And because ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu says this three times a day. He says, three times a day, Hashem says, oh, shame to Am Yisrael. But at the same time, he says, not only did I have to destroy my house and burn my temple, but he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says the following. When Am Yisrael go into their synagogues and their schoolhouses, HaKadosh Baruch Hu adds something else. What is he telling Rabbi Yose? You only heard part of it. You only heard the Chorban part because you were in a Chorva. You heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu lamenting the state of affairs of Am Yisrael and the destruction that he had to bring. But because you weren't on the streets, because you weren't with the people, you didn't get to hear the other side. You didn't get to hear the response. How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu respond? Hashem, every time that Am Yisrael davens together, in Batei Knesset and in Batei Midrash, Va'onin Yehei Shmei Rabba Mevorach, when Am Yisrael get together and they recognize that God is great and that they deserve to be punished, when they learn their lesson, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Menanei Arosho Va'omer, Ashrei HaMelech Shemekalsin Oto Beveito, Kach Malo La'av Sheheglad Benav. It's true that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is upset that he had to punish Am Yisrael. He had to send them to exile. Va'oilo Lahem Lebanim Shegalumi Al Shulchan Avihem. And then God's compassion comes forth and says, Chaval, shame that Am Yisrael had to be banished from the table of their father. And Rabbi Yossi doesn't hear this because he departed from the road. He isolated himself from the rest of society. And when he did that, he couldn't daven with the minyan. He couldn't say, Yehei Shmei Rabba Mivorach La'olam Ol Yomei Omaya. He couldn't say, may the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu be blessed, because he was so absorbed in the Chorban and in himself. And Eliyahu HaNavi tells him, that is not the way to respond to Chorban. Rabbi Tzadok was trying to change the people from within. And when that becomes too hard, you still don't leave the people. Rather, you join them. You join and you explain that we deserve this. And this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has cast upon us because of our own social misdemeanors. And when we're able to do that and recognize as a people and able to shout out together, Yehei Shmei Rabba, that's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks and says, those are the tefillot that I want. These are my children who on one hand I have cast away, and these are my children who one day, Be'ezrat Hashem, I will also bring back to my table, because this is the only manner in which Am Yisrael will learn the lessons of Chorban, and that is if they unite together and daven together, and if they recognize the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu with the proper perspective and the proper achdut. May we hope that the next few weeks bring tremendous and continued achdut of Am Yisrael. May we be zoche at times of simcha and siyumim to be able to yell Yehei Shmei Rabba Mevorach La'olam Olmei Omaya, and may HaKadosh Baruch Hu nod his head and say that the time has finally come, that we have learned the lessons of Sinat Chinam, that we have learned the lessons of the social misdemeanors, that we have learned what it means to come together as a kehillah, and Ve'ezrat Hashem, Vizochet together, L'gu'ula Shlema.